Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of Liberty Lands. I am your host, Big John, and as always, I am joined by my good friend and co-host, Mike Termott. And I promised Mike, things are breaking so fast this week, Mike, that we've already changed the subject of this episode three or four times before we turn the cameras on. So I made a promise to Mike.
We may change it during the recording of this.
We're nothing if not flexible, even at our advanced ages, Mike. But I will say something. I will promise to keep up, pay attention to what you actually say, and attempt to ask some intelligent questions as we go along the way. So,
things are moving so fast, your questions are likely to be a lot more intelligent than my responses. But let's see if we can at least make sure your audience is familiar with the big picture on some of these.
Yeah, and let's get started, because the one thing I will say about President Trump and his administration is they are operating at breakneck speed. Like, as soon as you get one announcement out of the White House, there seem to be three or four more, Mike. I don't know if this is part of a messaging plan, like sort of shock and awe, where you don't have time to really adjust or to come up with some thoughts necessarily on one thing before you hit with the other. So, sort of working in reverse shock order here from the recent events. The big one that happened late yesterday as we're recording this, which is the Trump announcement with Benjamin Netanyahu at his side that he wants the U.S. to take over the Gaza Strip. Give me your initial thoughts on that, because I think even Bibi was taken sort of aback by this announcement. It seemed like it wasn't a planned announcement. So what do you think? Is this for real? Is it a negotiating tactic of some sort? Well, give me your thoughts on
this. I think that's the big question. There ought to be two or three initial knee-jerk reactions.
Right.
As libertarians, I think most of us reacted with how. Right? Because we're obsessed with the idea that people need to have personal agency, need to have national agency, need to be able to self-determine what type of government they're going to have. So, you know, there is definitely, legalistically speaking, a how element in all of this. But I think, you know, you were going someplace similarly interesting, which is, is this going to stick? Is this real? Is this a negotiating ploy, a negotiating tactic? Did he really mean it the way that we heard it?
Right.
Because I think you're right. Netanyahu himself acted at that press conference as though, I don't know that he was completely shocked policy-wise, but I think that he might have been a little bit surprised the way it came out, as bald-faced, as unvarnished, as straightforward, seemingly without a lot of detail. You know, one might well imagine this is something that the two of them had discussed, but Netanyahu was not prepared for it to be delivered at the podium, right?
Right, right.
One of the reporters actually said he thought that Netanyahu reacted in a way that was sort of giddy. I would not disagree with that. He obviously was happy about it. There are many in Netanyahu's party in Jerusalem who want Israel to go all the way from river to sea, as many have accused the Palestinians of having said. But there are many in Netanyahu's government and political base who want to find a way to annex both the Gaza and the West Bank. What that actually means for the people of those territories is absolutely unclear. But we would not in any way, shape, or form welcome the idea of just wholesale marching people out, right, forcibly. That's not a thing that should happen, nor do I think it's very likely to be a thing that would happen. In this sense, once again, you and I have said this before, I don't think the president is getting the best staff work. I think that his communication team needs to challenge him in terms of the details and thoughtfulness behind some of these announcements, because I think that it's the president's role to be forward-thinking, to be a visionary, to think outside the box, to push the limits. I've got no problem with thinking, you know, things that maybe you and I wouldn't have thought of, right? Gee, that's creative. But you've got to have a staff that makes sure that every which way this might be received is considered before it goes through a microphone. And so I'm a little concerned that, you know, as much as I want to set my hair on fire today, this may be completely different by dinner time.
Agreed. And I'm willing to grant you that. Like and I think this is by design. I think the president does float out these ideas as trial balloons to see how people react. I think while there may be an underlying desire in what he says, personally, I think that there's way too much of a knee-jerk reaction. So having just put out that cautionary statement, I myself will now make a knee-jerk reaction, Mike, and you tell me what you think. Is it troubling to you, A, as an American, B, as a libertarian particularly, that the president in his early weeks here in office seems to be floating these ideas of annexation way too freely? We're talking about Greenland. We're talking about Canada becoming the 51st state. We're talking about possibly grabbing back the Panama Canal. Now we're talking about America owning Gaza. This is troubling to me. Just even if they're trial balloons, even if they're negotiating tactics, as I see a lot of his apologists say, is this the type of negotiating? Are these the type of things that we should be hearing verbalized from the White House?
The downside, the problem, the challenge, the risk is that because you expect the President of the United States to convey the long-term direction of the government, of foreign policy, and because the United States' long-term interest has always been articulated as being one of stability, you worry about such rhetoric undermining long-term relationships, and this is something that the president would understand well, investment commitments, both financial and in terms of, you know, soft capital diplomacy. You want your friends, Denmark and Panama and Canada at the top of those lists, right? You want your friends to be comfortable with your relationship so that you don't accidentally drive them into the arms of fill in the blank, the Chinese, the Russians, I dare say in weird circumstances, possibly even the Iranians. You don't want that to happen. You want to form not only international defense alliances, but trade alliances, trade environments in which people feel comfortable making long-term investments to drive down the cost and increase the availability for our supply chains, particularly when you've got Meshuggah hitting fans, right? The next time we have a COVID, I don't know what that means, right? Whether that's a natural disaster, a man-made disaster, whether it's a virus or some other bug. But the next time that supply chains are really internationally challenged, you're going to learn who your friends are and who they're not. And we want to be building those relationships now. We don't want people to worry, to be uncomfortable. And this is one of the reasons why tax policy, including tariffs, have to be considered in a long-term sense, even if it were the case that you had absolutely no intention of imposing the tariff, right? Other people don't know that, which is why, of course, it can be an effective negotiating tactic, is because people aren't sure you don't mean it. But if that's the case, then you've got to find a way to convey in the long run you don't mean it, right? In the long run, you can trust a big, expensive, committed relationship with the United States. It's like any other relationship. You know, if we're mad at each other at the moment, we need to decide, is that just, you know, at the moment, John, you feel like punching me in the face, but we've got to trust that in, you know, weeks and months and years to come, we're still going to be buddies. Otherwise, you know, who wants to make the investment in working together?
Right, right. And I see that as part of a lot of what when you see the back and forth between supporters and perhaps opponents of the president. One of the things the supporters always fall back on is look, man, he knows the art of the deal. He's the master negotiator. Look at this, look at that. And I do want to address this more when we get into our little bit of more detailed tariff discussion today. But very quickly, having now said that, because we said these are coming at breakneck speed, let's move on a little bit to some other announcements since our last episode. You know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I watched this interview with Milton Friedman when he was with, I think, the Hoover Institute doing an interview. And he laid out this thing of, listen, man, government can be knocked down to four departments, you know, and he was like, you know, state, justice, whatever. And he could count them all on four fingers. And it seems like that's what we're at least attempting to get now. So, again, as libertarians, we're proud of this, right? So, oops. Let's start out with USAID. Talk to me about that. Tell me what's going on with that. Let the people know why yep. is this a good thing, or is it a good thing, that this is being targeted for elimination by DOE?
I think it is a good thing, particularly if there's follow-through. If, on the other hand, this is some weird negotiation, which I believe it's not in the long run, but if it were, I wouldn't be so much for it because it really is going to undermine relationships.
Right.
But these are relationships that I believe should be managed by the president, international foreign policy relationships, a tool in which has been historically for many, many decades now, foreign aid. And I believe that we are learning, I believe that we have learned the hard way that these giveaways aren't a very good tool. They lead to corruption in too many cases, both domestically and abroad, by the way. They don't have the effect that you might want. We give money away to the Middle East to every kind of player, and nobody in the Middle East does what we want them to do. I mean, just as a practical matter, that doesn't sound very ethical, but if the object of the game is to, in effect, bribe governments into doing things that we want them to do, that's the starkest, harshest way to put that. But if you consider giving money away as a relationship development tool, wow, consider in the Middle East, we have given money to Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, the Kingdom of Jordan, the government of Egypt, the government of Lebanon, tons of money to the government of Israel, which I realize they have been a stalwart ally, but is odd in the context of their GDP per capita is something like 75% of ours. This is a very wealthy country. If I were to choose someone to bribe, you know, I'm not sure that's where I would look, right?
Right.
That is
right.
Not a nation that can be easily impressed by some billions of dollars, and yet we have attempted to do so for years. And we have learned that if our administration and theirs are not on good terms, a few billion dollars doesn't move that needle, nor should it.
Right.
So as a practical matter, I think the AID is, you know, let's give credit as best we can, a valiant experiment that just hasn't worked out very well practically. And as an ethical matter, I think not just as libertarians, but as Americans, we should have a problem with taking money away from Americans, including many of whom are among the least able to afford it, and give it to governments abroad and hope that they distribute it in ways that do their populations good. I get all that, but I think that we should have an ethical problem with that at the end of the day.
I agree with you, and I think most people would agree with you. I mean, I tend to temper these things that, oh, my God, we shouldn't be giving away money overseas. It's destroying our economy. I don't know that the economic argument is the correct one, because I think total foreign aid has been pretty steady in terms of outlay at like about 1%, 1.5%. So it's not destroying our economy, but I think more to what you just described, It's an ethical issue. It's an efficacy issue. And we're losing on both those accounts. So for that reason alone,
and considering how messed up trade relationships are and can be, they swamp the effect of giving money away.
I think
that these relationships really should be based on trade, which gives, of course, Americans the opportunity to get money, get rich, make a living. And I think that should be the object of the game, is for the government to facilitate us engaging in voluntary transactions.
You know, Mike, every time you say something like that, all I get mentally are images of Milton Friedman in his Free to Choose series, just explaining all this in very plain terms. But I get it, and you're absolutely right. One more department I want to touch on that's been targeted either for severe reduction or complete elimination, the Department of Education. Now, I think a lot of people forget. By a lot of people, I mean the everyday person who's not steeped in politics. If you talk to them, they seem to have this, and I've done this, and a lot of my family and friends are teachers, and so even they are like, well, why get rid of something that's so entrenched in our educational system? Why get rid of something? A lot of them don't realize the Department of Ed was created in 1979. It's not that, like, ancient a department, and it wasn't around when the American education system was on top. It actually has facilitated probably the decline of the American educational system, from a public perspective at least. Talk to me about that. Good thing, now that I've teed it up this way, good thing or bad thing? And do we think it's actually going to happen that the Department of Ed will be eliminated?
I think it will eventually be eliminated. I think it's going to require some legislation, because there's some money that the executive branch is obliged to be giving away. I do applaud the administration thinking outside the box and trying to stop those payments to states. I don't think most people realize that education worked just as well before the Department of Education existed, and that the real reason it exists, again, a valiant effort, a great experiment, but one that didn't work out very well. I think from a libertarian point of view, we would have been predicting that it wouldn't work out very well, because it's an attempt to concentrate power and influence at the federal level where it doesn't belong. Right. But at this point, I think that even an objective Democrat would have to admit that it's not working very well from their perspective. The nexus of this idea is that the Department of Education takes federal tax money, meaning money that's extracted from citizens of every state, and then gives it back to state governments with strings attached to try to manipulate them into managing their school systems the way that the federal government wants it to. And so, sure, one might argue it was with the best of intentions, but it has been a roadblock to change. And for that reason alone, whether you believe that the change that's coming were good or bad, any roadblock to change is per se a bad idea. We need states to be as flexible as possible. Now, having said that, the change that's coming is beneficial. We now have a movement in the United States of America towards school choice, which is the only way to save our crappy school system, is to open up competition among private sector and public sector institutions vying for the right to offer educational services. That's the only way to save this. And the Federal Department of Education has been in the way and needs to go.
Yeah, I think most people, again, maybe it's just the people I associate with, but I think most people would agree with that. Even folks who are already in the system can tell you that it's a failing system, and the results are what they are. You know, I love this one stat here in New York. As recently as 3-4 years ago, something like 95% of the PhD candidates in New York State were foreign students. They were not students who were raised in the U.S. educational system. So that, to me, like, especially as someone who has always put a premium on education, that's shocking to me. Like, where are all our geniuses coming from? So combine a crappy school system with perhaps a restrictive immigration policy, and you can easily see where the decline of American greatness is rolling quickly upon us.
Absolutely, and your observation, as keen as it is, brings up a whole nother point. which is the reason we see so many foreign graduate students, foreign national graduate students in our universities in the United States, is because our university system is absolutely the envy of the world. This is where you want to come to go to graduate school. Why is that? Well, that's because our university system is so much less dominated by the federal government and by state governments than our local primary and secondary education systems. It is not true that our primary and secondary education systems are dominated by foreign nationals bringing their kids over. No, if you're English, right, and you speak English, but you're in the United Kingdom, you're relatively happy with your primary and secondary education systems. You're not, you know, getting on an airplane and sending your kid to school in the United States or moving your family because the education system right here is so much better. That's not a thing. Whereas it is at the university level, that's all you need to know about the fact that federal dominance of these universities having been avoided is what makes them so great.
Yep, absolutely true. We're in agreement on that one. And so was Milton Friedman, as a matter of fact. So we're all aligned. Okay. The last thing I want to touch on is in terms of these sort of announcements before we get to our main topic of tariffs is the buying out or the offering of early retirement packages to a lot of federal workers, a lot of departments specifically. We've heard the FBI, the CIA.
Everybody at the CIA. Everybody at the CIA. Indeed, I wish this is how the FBI were handled. I'm not a big fan of the selective culling out of FBI agents, not only because I think that it introduces the possibility of at least a perception of bias right in how certain cases were managed. Never mind all that. I think the FBI should be broken up into pieces, and I think that, you know, all that anti-espionage stuff should be moved to the Department of Defense, for example, and most of the rest of the FBI should be outsourced to individual state agencies. But I love the idea that everybody at the CIA is being offered a package. I understand it's 8 months. 8 months of pay. You say goodbye. Boy, you've got to really believe in the mission of the CIA to turn that down, because these are smart, in most cases, young, well-educated, highly employable Americans who could absolutely find a great job sooner than 8 months, right? Right. And could figure out how to deploy 8 months worth of pay quite properly, thank you. So not be surprised if this were received fairly well and that the CIA were to shrink lickety-split.
Right.
there is a problem here, which is, there's a rumor that the White House has an inch. I don't know if this is true or not, so everyone take this with a grain of salt. But there is a rumor that the White House wants to replace CIA operatives with those that have not been tainted by past administrations' motivations, which I understand. I appreciate that. However, as a libertarian and just a CIA observer for many, many years, I first interviewed with the CIA when I was getting out of college. I think a lot of us did. Yep. It seemed like a bad idea, and I'm glad I didn't take them up on, you know, the career path that they were suggesting. I'm not optimistic that you can just replace people at the CIA and end up with an agency that would serve America's interests. I'm not impressed by this argument that says, well, you know, it's an anti-espionage organization and makes the world safer. It doesn't. It has historically made the world more dangerous. It is not an anti-espionage organization. It is an espionage organization. And it does things that in many cases we ought not be doing. And in this sense, I like the idea of offering everyone a buyout, everyone taking them up on the offer, and we shrink that agency down until we can shove it inside of maybe, you know, the Defense Department or something. I don't think Tulsi would miss it, which I think, brings up a whole lot of other issues, including Tulsi's hearing the other day, where she refused to call Edward Snowden a traitor. I'm telling you, I would have sent her future campaign $100 if she had looked the senator in the eye and said, not only is he a traitor, but I think that we should stop criminalizing people who reveal what it is that the government is doing when the government is doing something that is illegal, that is unconstitutional. How much fun would it have been if she had turned that table and said, Senator, when did you know that what we were doing was illegal, that it was a violation of the Constitution, and why didn't you disclose it? Because a violation of the Constitution, particularly for those of us who have taken the oath to the Constitution over and over again, that strikes me as traitorous.
Right, right. And you know, there's a lot in what you said, but just on the very practical matter, going back to the offering of the packages, right? I think that it strikes me that a lot of people kind of have this image of a CIA agent, probably cultivated through movies and TV shows and whatnot. You know, like, people forget, someone like William F. Buckley was in the CIA. A lot of these CIA employees are just, like, for lack of a better term, really nerdy people who typically never leave their office, may spend 12 hours a day in front of a computer or with their nose in books, or at most listening to foreign language transcripts, or, you know, they're really like nerdy, bookish people. And to your point, their skills are very transferable. Think about cryptographers. Think about coders. Think about translators. So to someone like that.
And engineers, when they talked to me 100 years ago, it was, you know, I was getting out of engineering school. And, you know, they weren't going to hand me a gun and theme music. They wanted me to look at pictures of Russian airplanes and try to figure out what they could do. You know, that was not bikinis and beachside daiquiris.
No James Bond stuff. You know, my interview ended before it began because I went in there. And less than 24 hours later, they had figured out that one of my mother's distant relatives was a communist organizer in Greece in like 1920 or something. Someone that even my mother had never heard of. This was overnight. I am not. And one of Casey's reps basically said, "We don't take your type. Go work for the FBI." That was the conclusion.
That was probably a good call on their part. Maybe America would have been better off. But the CIA would have been in deep shit if you had gotten on the inside of that thing.
Right, right. So just funny that, you know, but yeah, to that point, I think there's a lot of people. It'd be interesting to see the statistics on who took them up on that package, because and how much and if there's going to be any backfill. Because to your point, the point is to shrink the CIA, not replace it necessarily with Trump loyalists. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that works.
Fill it with a bunch of Trump loyalists, maybe even a bunch of libertarian-minded government skeptics. I just fear that over time, mission creep would take over, and you know, the psychology being what it is, it really undermines your independence. There's an old saying in Washington: "Where you sit is where you stand."
Yep, absolutely. Okay. Now, let's move on to something that we were initially prepared to talk about because it's time, and this is where all my notes are, Mike. So let's talk about tariffs. Tariffs, especially with this president, seem to be a favorite topic. It's always top of mind. The solution to everything seems to be a tariff in President Trump's mind. So I just want to read his proposed tariffs, official proposed tariffs, and official implemented tariffs. As of February 5th, so that would be today, this morning, President Trump has proposed a 25% tariff on all imports from Canada and Mexico, a 10% tariff on energy resources from Canada, a 10% tariff on all imports from China. And this kind of snuck in there, Mike. I wasn't aware of this till I was doing my research. These tariffs are in addition to any existing tariffs that might be in duty rates that are out there.
Yeah, layered on top.
Layered on top. So the effective tariff is probably higher. And here's the other thing. The de minimis treatment on shipments under $800 has been eliminated, meaning that when you and I, yeah, go ahead.
That's a pain in the ass fee.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So basically, we're going to have a pain in the ass fee if you and I decide to order a new microphone off of eBay from China and they have to drop ship it, right? Or, yep. You know, if we want some Canadian bacon that might cost us $50 e-commerce. And this is called, this was the e-commerce exemption to tariffs, is commonly referred to, because this is when people hopped online for something they just needed the next day or whatever, right? Low cost and things like that. In addition to what I just mentioned, these are some of the things President Trump has mentioned. We mentioned the 25% tariff on all imports from Mexico and Canada. Potential tariffs on European Union nations, which President Trump has indicated might occur, quote, very soon. A possible across-the-board tariff on 10% of all foreign goods entering the United States blanket. President Trump is considering declaring a national economic emergency to justify a new broad tariff program using the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. So, in other words, President Trump loves him some tariffs. Mike, we've heard the arguments pro and con. Give me your Austrian economist and libertarian perspective on tariffs and whether we should be using them as part of some gunboat diplomacy.
Those are two really different questions. In the long run, we know that tariffs are bad for us and they're bad for everybody else. And that's a much easier statement for an economist than for most people. We know that they drive up costs. They drive up costs for consumers. The issue, and for everybody, you know, for employees, for investors, for everybody in the supply chain, and that's a problem. That's a problem. The issue is whether or not you mean it, right? Again, we're back to the White House. We're back to President Trump using these statements as negotiating tactics. I think that, yeah, we need to say kudos to the White House for achieving these at least temporary agreements with Canada and with Mexico. The Mexican government has agreed to send troops to the border, which I think most people consider to be a good thing. That's a completely different conversation, how the border should be controlled. But if you wanted the Mexican government and the Canadian government to help with border control, you are forced to hand it to the administration today and say that they were able to achieve those commitments. Now, one might suggest that those commitments might have been achieved without threatening something that could risk sending a long-term signal of undermining long-term investments and relationships, as we discussed earlier. So I don't know that that was the best way to do it, but you do have to admit that from the president's perspective, this was successful. In the long run, tariffs can only be successful in a couple of very specific circumstances. One is that there are markets that your nation so dominates that they can force the costs on others and, in effect, save money because the costs are not going to be moved on to your consumers, but the tax money is going to make your government stronger and you're going to be able to reduce taxes. Theoretically, that can happen, but only in markets where you are absolutely the dominant player.
Where, right? You mean in artificial, uncompetitive markets?
In an uncompetitive market. Those are not what we're typically talking about. The other circumstance where it can be fruitful is if there are other strategic objectives other than just lowering costs and, you know, for your consumers and making your economy work better. So if you really believe that we should not have certain Chinese companies in our supply chains, now, one might suggest a better way to do that is just say, no, you can't buy from those companies, right? It's difficult to employ that. It's difficult to deploy that as a tactic. And so there is an argument that the right way to go about that is to transition away from certain elements in your supply chain, whether that's China altogether, whether that's regions in China, elements of certain Chinese industries or certain companies, but to transition away from that can be accelerated by the imposition of a tariff that would protect the development or encourage the development of those supply chains being domestically based. And you could impose a tariff on companies in nations that you just don't trust. China is the leading example, not because these companies are inherently evil, but because the Chinese government maintains, I'm going to try to put this politely, a strong relationship with large companies that are domiciled in China. It is true that companies of any size, any, you know, serious number of employees is going to have in its place of business a representative of the Communist Party, not just the government of the People's Republic. And so it is difficult to trust that that supply chain is going to hold up under stress if the relationship between the United States government and the Chinese government were to go south. So I get that. What I wish is that the White House did a better job of explaining that. Because alternatively, when you just lump them all together, right? We're going to put a tariff on Chinese companies, Canadian companies, and Mexican companies. Well, I'm sorry, those are for three very different reasons. And it just makes it look like, what, you trust a Canadian supplier no more than a Chinese supplier who's dominated by the Communist Party and the People's Republic of China? That's weird. That can't possibly be true. Frankly, the same thing with a Mexican company. The reason you're pressuring the Mexican economy is to get pressure on the Mexican government to get them to do things that you want to do. That's very different. Now, in some cases, you do want to pressure the Chinese companies into pressuring the Chinese government into doing things that you want them to do. But in the case of China, that's very challenging because that presupposes that the Chinese government is going to feel pressured by the economic well-being of these companies. And that's typically not the case. The Chinese government can withstand all kinds of bad things happening to its citizens without changing the long-run course. They play a very long game. Right. And that is not affected by, oh dear, you know, our consumers are paying 5% more for X, Y, or Z. Right. That's not a thing that happens. Right. Whereas it very much is in an economy like Canada, where the leadership is extremely sensitive to domestic voting, right?
Right, right, right.
And the big challenge in Mexico, even if you could convince yourself, well, the Mexican government is going to be deeply affected if we drive up costs or threaten to drive up costs on its consumers, that may be because that is a democracy just like Canada. The problem is the Mexican government doesn't even have control over the northern part of Mexico. So you're asking them to do something that is not only very difficult for them to do, but arguably impossible for them to do. Notice that the agreement was we'll send 10,000 troops.
Right.
There's no promise that that's going to do any good.
Right. Yeah, right. And I mean, I get the strategic imposition of tariffs. I get it. But to your point, A, is the messaging. B, is this a default position now for the United States? Because I view this as a form of gunboat diplomacy. Or, like, the more personal thing is, I love negotiating. I especially love negotiating against somebody who's half my size And I love negotiating by putting my arm around, my hand around their throat and squeezing until they agree to the art of the deal. So that's like, there's a lot of different layers here. Also, Mike, I get your point. Hey, do we need supply chains dependent on a hostile nation? Do we need supply chains on dependent on an untrustworthy nation? Rather than impose a tariff which ultimately is paid by the American people, again, it's a tax. It's a tax on the American people that benefits a favored political class at any given moment, correct?
Richard Nixon used to say, it's like threatening someone, do what I tell you to do or I'm going to blow my own brains out all over your new suit.
Right, right. Lord George said this back in the late 1800s. With tariffs, we accomplish in peacetime to ourselves what we would only do to our enemies during war. So there's always, you know, a lot of people, different ways of saying it. You're shooting yourself in the foot. You're biting your nose to spite your face. Any one of these cliches you want to use.
It's an expensive proposition. And so, you know, we saw President Trump look into the camera and say, yeah, you know, there might be some disruption, some cost. The American people will understand that. Well, he could be right, but he needs to articulate why it's so damned important. So if he were to say, look, the border is just this important. And so it's a patriotic thing to do, to use tariffs to force these people to do what we want.
Yeah.
Having Chinese companies in our supply chains is something that we need to avoid. It's just so important that we're going to have to suck up some extra costs. If he gives us that speech, I think that it's received differently. There's another angle on this that I think needs to be teased out. I used to teach some international trade and international finance 1,000 years ago.
Right.
And one of the things that I learned at the time was that the trade regime between the United States and other nations around the world, it is better. Trading with the United States is better, but it's still a mess. There's still all kinds of rules, hurdles. It's right. Not easy, right? It's not easy for American investors to invest abroad. It's not easy necessarily for others to invest over here. There are all kinds of regulatory challenges and red tape, as well as cultural challenges and risks. Okay, we get all that. Having said that, there are therefore improvements that can be made. Significant improvements that can be made. The White House leaves you with the impression that the only way to pressure these people is with threats of bad things happening. Imagine how much better that goes down if the threat is, I can make this better. I can make this a lot better. Let me explain how, right? Tax breaks and lower, corporate taxes, all of the things we see, you know, the stupid things that governors do to compete with each other in states in the United States that we as libertarians hate, right? And the president did say, we can get you permits if, you know, you make an investment of, I don't remember what his number was. It was like $100 million or something. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing you ought to be saying for everybody. And maybe it's on a nation-by-nation basis. But
right.
These are promises that can really move the needle. And you can say to a head of state, I'm going to send our trade rep out of there, and I want a deal, and then I'm going to send the Secretary of State, and then I'm going to send the Vice President, and then I'm going to send me. And at each step, we're going to announce that, you know, we're hitting certain goals in terms of making your nation a better place for American investors and vice versa, and right. We're going to become closer trading partners. But here's what I need, right? And then go ahead and, you know, I need the 10,000 troops at the border, or I need you to promise you're going to shut down the fentanyl trade with China. Whatever it is you're asking for, ask for it, get it on the list. But I'm just suggesting that there's a lot more there than most Americans appreciate in terms of upside that you can promise that arguably rivals how much pain you can cause by a tariff.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I do understand that there's the economic and the political when you talk about tariffs, and they both have to be weighed. You know, I'm just frustrated, I have to tell you, because the messaging lends itself to some patriotic nonsense, I think.
And like the Canadians booing the Star Spangled Banner at a hockey game.
You have simple stuff like that. You have, I've seen this on Twitter, right? You have some Americans saying like, well, I don't buy anything that's Canadian. Who cares if they reciprocate tariffs or, you know, whatever. These aren't going to affect me. Like, not understanding that, I use the old example, all of us use it, like, trade imbalances, trade deficits are not in and of themselves axiomatically bad. They're not evil That's just because right. you have a trade deficit, right? Like, I have a trade deficit with my local ShopRite. They never buy any of me. They never buy ad space on Liberty Lens, Mike, and I give them tons of money. My son's a big eater, as is his father, right? So we're always in the grocery store. I have a huge trade deficit with my local grocery store. But we're both getting what we need out of it. It's voluntary. We get what we need out of it. If I threaten to go to another grocery store, maybe there's a sale, maybe there's a coupon, maybe there's a loyalty program they offer me. And it's really the same thing when it comes to tariffs on trade, you know, on international trade. It's really that simple. So that's the economic aspect that tariffs are bad. I understand your point.
Now, trade balances, just like with your grocery store, Your grocery store has to spend that money somewhere. When we buy things from companies in other countries, those dollars have got to go somewhere. They are coming back, and they are coming back in the form of investment in the United States, which ultimately drives up wages, which is exactly what we want. In the long term, there's really no such thing as these trade deficits. They are only, as we say, current account, short-term trade deficits, but the investment evens things out because those dollars have got to come back.
Yeah, and it's to your point, it's current account, but it's also very narrow focus when you're talking about a trade deficit, right? Because you're not talking about the overall effect on the economy. You're not talking about political I remember, what was it, in the first Trump administration, some tariffs had so hit the American people that he then had to go to Congress to get subsidies for the industries that were negatively affected by reciprocal tariffing. So Now all of a sudden, not only are you hurting the American consumer in general through increased prices, reduced supply and things of that nature, you're also hitting them up because now you're subsidizing the industry. And of course, at that point, they're free to raise their prices without any competition as well. So it's bad as all the way around. Mike, you know, we're getting near the end of the show. Give me your final thought on this week that we just lived through.
This week is one of those weeks that reminds us that elections have consequences. And it should remind us that the government of the United States has been a big mess for a long time. Many of the things that the White House is doing right now are things that libertarians want to have had done, maybe done differently. I continue to be critical of a lot of the communication coming out of the White House and the timing. I wish that they would slow down and explain things better because I think that they would pull along more of the American people. I think they would pull along more people like you and me, right, who want to believe in things like shrinking the CIA,
right,
but to do it in a way that doesn't just open it up to replenishing it with, you know, 500 other people who you're going to manipulate into doing your bidding. There are ways to go about this that can be quite effective in the long run. And I think it's therefore one of those things that reminds us not only that the government has been messed up for a long time, but suggests that next week is going to be extremely important as these things begin to play out. And I look forward to talking to you then.
Absolutely. We're here for the whole show, Mike. We're not leaving at halftime. So until next time, I want to remind everyone, this has been Liberty Lens with Mike Termott and me, Big John. Catch us every Thursday right here on grumblingsmedia.com and also on your favorite social media platforms. We're everywhere, Mike. Until next time, peace, everyone.